Hello and welcome to Men's Magazines on Sunsounds Radio at sunsounds.org. I'm your host, Robert Streit, and Men's Magazines focuses on the arts, culture, commentary, and in-depth news reporting as found in both the domestic and the international editions of GQ, Esquire, and Men's Health. In this edition, for the second week of April 2025, we will be reading a series of Esquire articles on fatherhood. The ins, the outs, and the very unexpecteds. We will begin with New Dad, a personal journal entry from Scott Rabb, who donated sperm as a young man and came to learn decades later that he was a father. Many times over. Surprise! And from there, we will cover a series of articles on dads versus fathers, the taboo question of favorite children, and a son's admission that his pop might just have been right about a thing or two. Before we begin, though, I must mention that Men's Magazines includes adult content and, on occasion, language which some might find offensive. Having said that, I encourage you to sit back, relax, and enjoy Men's Magazines. The author made a few bucks donating sperm back in the day. 30 years later, there was a phone call. Then another. What happens when you suddenly have a new family at 71? New Dad by Scott Rabb. On Saturday, August 19th, 2023, 2 weeks after I turn 71, I become a new father. Again. I'm not expecting, nor is Lisa, who's 67, and while I'm pleased to say that 30 years on we still savor each other head to toe and in several other positions, our reproductive job was over with when Judah was born in 1999, and we knew it. We had started late. I was married once before, 10 years, no kids, and Lisa and I were past 40 and craving it all, parenthood, love, redemption. Judah was our last shot. Imagine that pressure. Not on us, on him. Lisa and I were ready. I don't know if any child is ready, but Judah caught on right away to the basics. Cry, suckle, piss, shit, and took it from there. When I was the age he is now, in 1976, I was a geek in search of a carnival, drinking hard, writing poetry, welcoming my worst instincts every day. Judah's working on a PhD in chemistry at UCLA. We followed him out to Los Angeles instead of aging out alone in New Jersey because we love him and he loves us. He comes by every Saturday for lunch, usually with Greta, his girlfriend. He arrives alone today, which in itself signifies nothing much, but his smile's tight. There's a vibe. A doting, aging father feels these things. We kiss, we hug, we sit. Lisa's behind him, standing with her back to us, dishing red lentil dal, grabbing spoons, asking how Greta's doing. So, I say once Lisa's at the table. What? I see it in his eyes, steel blue, flecked with black. He knows I see it. He favors the Brennans, Lisa's people, lean, long-muscled, free of my flat feet and black hair and quiet. But in one room, we share one brain. I raise my eyebrows. He lifts his. Of course, like Lisa, he wants me to ask. Information withheld is power. Bad news we'd have dumped by now. Bub, I say. Bub, he says. Not once has he ever called me dad. We're not pals either. We are men, and Bub works fine. Bub, I croak low. What is up? He grins, eyes wide and wet. It's not the jalapenos in his mama's doll. He's feeling something. A lot. So I heard from this woman yesterday. He says she's pretty sure I'm her brother. Lisa, Judah, and me, the nuclear family stripped to its minimum with little space for secrets, we all know how this has happened. Over the years, I've talked lightheartedly about my time as a sperm donor in the early 1990s and the possibility that my seed had spread without my knowledge. It was during my first marriage to a wonderful woman who didn't want to be a mother any more than I cared about becoming a father. She earned a medical residence paltry stipend, and I raked in $40 a pop when a local alternative weekly found my columns to its taste. I was writing short fiction, too, and working on a novel and putting too many basics on credit cards. A different man might have thought about getting a job. Fuck that. I've known since age 12 that I was alive to write. It was a calling, not a career. I was about to turn 40. My wife had her medical degree and would soon make real money, so no, I wasn't going back to selling shoes. Luckily, the hospital had established a fertility clinic, new and uncommon then, and male medical students and spouses were more than welcome to pitch in as donors. And donors got paid. I don't recall the precise amount, but it was less than half the $100 I was paid by the same hospital for letting them extract my monocytes, white blood cells, once a month. My sperm, on the other hand, I could peddle twice a week, every week, assuming that my boys passed muster at the clinic. It was not easy to ejaculate in the small room dedicated to production, but I made do. Mine's a practiced hand, and both my sperm count and motility made the grade. I felt truly good about it, in a primitive, not to say stupid way. I'd never made a woman pregnant. Didn't worry or wonder if I could, yet I felt proud. I don't think it ever dawned on me that what I was doing was in any way altruistic, that I could be helping strangers whose yearning for parenthood had proved fruitless. Never crossed my mind, that part. Why would it? I'd signed page after page of forms at the clinic, waiving all paternal rights and any access to information about whether my arrows ever hit the bullseye. No worries. I just kept providing samples of my puissant Ashkenazi jizz. My biological daughter began searching for me after telling her parents that she was going to submit a sample for genetic testing. She was nearing 30 and planned to marry and start a family one day soon and wanted to know if she carried markers of diseases prevalent among Eastern European Jewry and their descendants. Only then did her parents reveal that she had been conceived with donor sperm. Some secrets grow larger than others. Lisa and I have been frank with Judah about our family histories, including alcoholism. We've kept secret about our abortion. There's no right or easy time to share such secrets with an only child. My biological daughter's folks told her the truth because they knew that she would find out anyway. I understand why they kept it secret all her life. She found a genealogist who matched her with a sample that one of my brothers had sent in years before. I don't know why that putz, trust me, did this. He has four children from his two marriages, and their parentage is, I assume, no mystery, but I am forever thankful that he did. The genealogist knew from his address history that my brother could not have been the clinic donor. She then searched mine. Et voila. Same town, same time frame, same genes, new dad. Ah, but wait, the genealogist also turned up another biological child, a son. His parents, like his new sisters, hadn't told him. His new, marginally older sister did. She also tried to reach me through my disused website. Got no reply, then emailed Judah, who answered her at once and told us the next day over lunch. Three kids, three freshened souls, three beating hearts, three brains electric in the wondrous world. Three families I made whole. I, raised by no man, am a godling, and this I swear, is no mere revelation. It is revelation. I am that I am, creator of life, seed of small multitudes, a real patriarch at last. That's how weird it hit. The rush of manic, massive, meteoric joy. I'd followed my son out to Los Angeles, aging fast. I wasn't looking for a fresh start. I needed lymphoma treatment. I wasn't exactly dying. What I've got is a rare blood cancer, incurable but highly treatable. But I couldn't start treatment in New Jersey due to COVID. Within a couple weeks of landing in L.A., I was a patient in a clinical trial at a cancer center called City of Hope, and I'm in complete remission now. Thrilling, I know, but wait. The cancer drugs fucked up my immune system, too, and COVID isn't in complete remission. Not for me, not for Lisa, nor for Judah, who gets PCR tests twice a week to make sure he doesn't get me sick. Our lives, mine and Lisa's, have shrunk in ways that have frightened and fortified and broken us both. Yet here we are in L.A. with our son, weeping at the news that my family tree just sprung two new branches. Lisa's shining at me, dazzled by another magic trick. We met toward the end of my donor days. I'd been a faithful husband to my first wife for 10 years when we found each other. She never felt like a midlife crisis. Fate is fate. I told my wife that I had betrayed her, that I was in love. She was willing to work on it, to try to forgive me, to save us. And so we saw a couples therapist, and I tried fidelity and failed. I could not live my life without Lisa. It didn't feel like a choice. In those days, Lisa and I were far too drunk, far too often to plan a family or much else. She was 36, a terrific journalist, an OG feminista who had never worn makeup or pierced her ears. She was single, with no thought of marriage or of motherhood, and plenty of remorse over being the other woman. I was just starting out on my first Big Shot magazine contract, a thing I didn't even know existed. Lord, we went nuts, Lisa and me. She got pregnant quick. I was not too drunk to feel excited about the prospect, but I wasn't the partner carrying our zygote. I stayed drunk and stoned around the clock. I felt relief when she decided not to keep it, and I hated myself for being alive. I was a writer, yeah, a writer with a golden MFA, meeting just the right people, editors, agents, colleagues, friends, at just the right time. So what? What did I amount to as a human, as a man? A flea, a 42-year-old dingleberry hanging from Sandy Robb's scrotum. I'd blown up my marriage, knocked up my soulmate, and wound up driving her to and from our abortion. I was a worse man than my own shit-heeled father. His own father had walked out on his wife and 5 young kids in the Great Depression. My father saw his father again only once. That hoodlum died before I came along in 1952. In 1960, my father dragged my mother and their 3 sons, the youngest 2 weeks old, to Los Angeles against my mother's will. Sandy Robb, shortened from Rabinowitz, his mother's maiden name, needed a fresh start. In L.A., he started fresh with another woman, and when my mother found the other woman's bra, she hauled us back to Cleveland to her parents' house where my writing life was born. The man of my grandparents' house lived in the unfinished basement in a crude open cell hammered in slats from junk wood. The geek, the missing link to my lineage in plain sight. If only I'd been old enough to know it, to glean his awful secrets. If I'd known my grandfather's tiny, tragic life, I never would have tried to murder him. He had sailed to America in 1920, a young man from Slovakia. He was the only one of 8 siblings to emigrate. In 1944, he had tried to get Turkish visas for them and their own families, but the cattle cars to Auschwitz had departed Košice already, full. His family tree burned down to the roots in the Shoah. He aspired to art. He painted, he wrote, and he yearned to become an operatic Shazan, but he was an unskilled laborer, washing train cars at the New York Central Yard all his working life. He wrote and painted and sang prayers in Hebrew down in the basement with the rats. He'd retired before my mother and brothers and I got there. My grandmother was still working, a bakery clerk. They had been in America 40 years and never owned a car or ate in a restaurant or went to see a movie. They lived in a small neighborhood of immigrant Jews, most, like my grandparents, Orthodox, including many Holocaust survivors, and their Yiddish and their Hungarian were more fluent by far than their broken English. There were seven of us in all, my grandparents, my mother, my brothers and me, and stuck in a wheelchair in one of the three bedrooms, breathing with the help of a tall metal oxygen tank painted industrial green, my grandmother's mother, who died within a week of our arrival, freeing up the biggest bedroom for us three boys. Six Jews, one bathroom on the second floor with an ancient tub and no shower. The attic held an Everest of toilet tissue, ancient half-sheets swiped from the railroad, and box after cardboard box of neckties commemorating the 1936 Great Lakes Exposition, which the old man had failed to sell. We'd come with nothing but our clothes, left our childhoods and the family we thought we were 2,000 miles away. My mother's sister and brother had young families of their own in town. The old man's insanity in the long war between my grandparents was a secret only to me and my brothers. We were objects of pity, the war orphans, the sad little boys pining for their cheating bastard of a father whose meager child support checks were forever late or light. I heard it all, and I stuck Uncle Manny's hand-me-down black loafers on my two big feet, and my mother said to thank him for his heart of gold, and I thanked him while my soul slowly roasted in my hate for every one of them. I lived in his house for 5 years and never knew my grandfather's first name. To my mother, he was Daddy, but Graham never called him anything but Ip or Ippish, so that's what we called him. Decades later, I found out that Ippish is the Yiddish word for stench. Graham never missed a shot. I had known my grandparents before we left Cleveland for Los Angeles, but this version of that man I had never met before. I don't know how long he'd been living in the basement. Nobody had explained anything to me about why our family broke, what lay ahead. Nothing. I can't recall who told me before we left for my grandparents' house that I, as the oldest child, would need to be the man of the family and protect my mother and brothers. I had just turned 10. My grandfather wore filthy, sagging suits and yellowed dress shirts. We had no washing machine or dryer. I'm not sure where he defecated. He wasn't tall or thick. He was a scowling, wary orangutan, his wiry arms lost inside his clothes. The only place he ever went was the synagogue, and the suit he wore trailed his scent in the morning. Snuff, shit, failure. When he got home from shul, they'd go at it. I never heard a kind word exchanged between my grandparents, nor a word of English. They screamed curses in Yiddish and Hungarian, not to spare us, but because that's all they ever spoke in the house. And when words failed to quench their thirst for rage, they went at it hand to hand, though Graham preferred her broom or a pot or the water heating in the pot. Trauma's real. When I choose to look back, I remember very little of my life during those 5 years. My youngest brother, barely 3 years old, often sat up screaming, eyes wide open, in his bed, and I couldn't shake or shout him awake. My other brother just puked a lot. Graham brought home plenty of pastry from the bakery, the pastries, coconut bars, hi-hats, Dobos tort. I can still taste. And to this day, I can see Graham, a fireplug with old country muscles, bringing her broomstick down hard on Ip's bony, stubbled skullcap head, and I hear her shout, "Call de police!" I call. By the time the cops knock on the door, the ape-armed geek is downstairs in his cage, and Graham shoos away the law. My mother was either at work. She was a part-time receptionist for a dermatologist in the medical building where her pharmacist brother ran the drugstore, or occupied with finding an unmarried Jewish man willing to become her second husband and a father to her three sons. Lucille let me know by a thousand shrieks that I was heavy baggage, the death of her romantic dreams. Worse, when my mother looked at me, she saw Sandy Robb's thick-lipped glower reflected in her firstborn's face. I didn't feel unloved. I was hated. I went dark in year two inside that shtetl asylum for jailed Jews. I got fat and fatter. Schoolwork went undone or missing. I broke my violin. Many a nice Jewish boy grew up to become a Yaakov Heifetz or Jack Benny with his fiddle, and I left it smashed in the instrument locker at school and denied I'd done it. No one cared. 4 days a week after school, I took the short bus to an Orthodox Jewish academy run by rebbes with beards decades older than Mrs. Gifford, the buxom young Hebrew teacher whose avatar inspired the one and only good thing that happened to me in the 5 years we lived at 1896 Staunton Road, my first load of fruitful sperm. They wanted a nice Jewish boy. I wasn't. I was a feral Hebrew, helpless, with no more to lose in the world. I'd had enough. I recruited my brother Dave to help me kill Ippish. The old man walked each morning to services at the synagogue. Before we got home that day, we wedged pennies between the front door and the frame so tight that it would not push open, forcing Ip to walk up the driveway to reach the back door, a floor below and a few feet left of the second floor porch where Dave and I crouched with every sharp knife in our grandmother's kitchen drawers in our fists. I rose with bloody murder in my heart, and Dave stood, too, and we rained our knives, meat and dairy mixed, upon our nemesis, who howled and skittered roach-like back down the driveway, unscratched. A silly plan poorly executed, but my intent and my commitment were sincere. Still, no one called the cops or child welfare. No one said fuck all to me about it. I was free to slip into a waking coma that went on for many years and included many bad days. If not for writing, I do believe I'd be in custody or dead today. I saw my father once a year for a few years after the divorce. He had a second wife. He cheated on her, too, and a fresh young son. By the time he died, my father and I hadn't spoken for a couple of years. He left me a Sugar Ray Robinson poster I didn't want. It's in my half-brother's garage in Burbank, and a black hole of pure grudge. My mother eventually found two more husbands after I got out of the son business. By the time of her death, we hadn't spoken for several years. She disinherited me in her will. My two brothers, who couldn't stand her either, she hid the youngest from my father on the few trips he made to see us, and who watched me break up close, made sure I got my piece of change despite the two paragraphs specifically barring me from any bequest whatsoever. Respect, Lucille. If revenge is best served cold, you crushed it. I did not escape my mother's orbit hating all women. I was only properly terrified of them and never wished to find more than one whom I could love and who'd love me for the brute that I truly am. Lisa and I got sober in 1994 and got hitched in 1997, surer of our footing in the world. She got pregnant with Judah in 98. Like me, she was an eldest child and a hostage to a cruel and abusive mother. But Lisa had a secret that she shared with me and Judah. Love. More love. Then more love, then more, and more, and more. Always more, always, because nothing teaches you to love harder than not getting any when you need it most. She taught us both. I had no idea how much love a person can feel and give, the glorious infinitude of it. I'm no evangelist for parenthood, far fucking from it, but Lisa and Judah answered the most crucial question I ever had about the value and meaning of my own life. What do I amount to as a man? I am a loving and beloved father and husband. Good enough. Judah met his new sister before I did. She's very smart, he told me, very intense. What a shock, I said. Judah was correct. She's fierce, Ivy-schooled, multi-degreed, driven as hell, in the right way. She'll help heal this broken world, and Lord, is she a pleasure to behold. I met her for the first time, and her fiancé and her dog, in a cemetery. Her dark eyes burn like a warrior's, even as she smiles when I go in for a hug. I see the resemblance, I say, and catch her. Cringe? Wince? Ach, too soon, way too soon. I have no idea what she sees when I take off my N95. I'm a brown-toothed septuagenarian with sagging jowls and a row of missing upper molars. She resembles the shape of her face, the square footage of her forehead, me on a good day a half century ago. Really, she says, I don't see it. I would not have been so confident a girl dad, I think. I had no sisters. I have no clue to so many of Lisa's nether mysteries, and I have come to see over the course of my life that even the best men, present company included, are brutish. I was so worried that I'd make a jackass of myself. Done and done. So I thank her over and over again for finding me. I gush while Lisa spreads a blanket, and we all, Lisa and Judah, my new daughter and her fiancé, a new family, sit and talk about our families and careers, and we drink each other in. Are you going to write about this? She asks. I've already got the first sentence. They're planning their wedding, and of course we'll be invited. Thanksgiving's coming up soon, and her parents will be flying in, and we'll all meet up then. I am continuously astonished to see her in front of me, the five of us in a small circle, and her big, sweet dog nestled in the grass. It is beyond anything I ever dreamed for myself, my family, mine. Love, more love, an infinitude of love and gratitude to her, to her parents, to genetic test peddlers and all the genealogists, and always to the force that, through the green fuse, drives the flower. Listen, I'm not here to tell you there's a plan, that there are no accidents. None of that is necessary to see that the plan itself is self-evident. We are here to keep the species going. You need not be a person of God or science to accept the obvious and work from there. And we must pause for station identification. You're listening to Men's Magazines on Sunsounds Radio at sunsounds.org. And now our piece on the new dad. The bad news is that my new daughter didn't yet know how rough a time her folks were having dealing with all of it. I'm not sure why exactly, and it isn't my business. I have not met them. I missed the wedding, too. Someday we'll gather, and I will have a chance to thank them face to face. I hope. Meanwhile, we keep in touch. She and her husband and Judah and Greta are friends. It is far more than good enough. To know that she is out there is pure joy for me, and I tell her so. I know my biological kids now. Even to know that I need to shield them and their folks herein. For me, it's simple. I'm a mere fact. They both have real, actual dads, two men who were, are, and forever will be. They're true fathers. Judging by their kids' grace and kindness, they are both fabulous dads. My new biological son was blown away when he heard from his new sister. His folks hadn't told him either. He drove through a couple of states to meet her, and she texted me photos of them together, and damn it, I'm not so wrong about their big smiles. Just like each other's, and not unlike my own, except gleaming. He and I haven't met, not yet. I'm still immunocompromised, afraid to travel and fall ill on the road. But from the first time we talk on the phone, I feel like I've known this guy forever. I checked my phone, and our shortest conversation to date has lasted 1 hour and 7 minutes. That not brief chat was our first, and we covered some family acreage before we got to sports and ranking Coen Brothers movies. I saw Blood Simple in Iowa 10 years before he was conceived, and then he asked about being half Jewish, and I talked a little about growing up in an Orthodox household and becoming an irreligious Jew before fatherhood re-knit that umbilical inside me. The hard part came after I told him how grateful I was to his mom and dad, how important it felt for me to thank them. And that's when he told me that his dad was sick with late-stage organ cancer. "I can't tell them," he says. "It would kill them both." I don't think his voice sounds like mine, not like Judah's does, but I hear the same heart, a mensch. Time is fragile, irreplaceable. Not for sale at any price. It's better not to think about this until you're aging or ailing or very high. We are animals who swoon into love, who cry and laugh and study quantum physics and massacre each other, all to hold at bay the dread certainty of our common fate. What can we do to help? Whatever can we do? Don't ask me. Know thyself. I've done my part, and then some. Now, should they so choose, it is in my kids' hands, among several other places. Last time we spoke, my new son talked of having kids. A patient, thoughtful guy, he wants to feel more settled first, with a house, not an apartment. His wife's starting a new job. The country and the world's immediate future is hard to feel good about, and there's a lot to think through first. He's right all the way, not that he's asking my advice or needs it. I'm just grateful he feels like talking about it with me. "One more thing," I say, because I can't help myself, and we're laughing anyway. "When you decide to give it a go, I guarantee your boys will bring the mojo." After we talk, I always feel foolish, heavy-handed, full of shit. Who and what I am to these biological children but a guy who came into a cup last century and kept it cold? What can I possibly mean to them? I figure they'll let me know, and my shot at grandfatherhood has tripled. Good enough. But I think about what my new son said, about wanting to feel settled like we did, in a place of his own like we did. I don't like the trend, not for my kids, for their kids, nor our country's future, nor the world's. So what? You get old, you decay, you're not supposed to like the trend or the state of the world. Landing here in 1952 was genius on my part. It was a sweet spot for Jews for all the wrong reasons, and for American Jews in particular, and for American Jewish male writers especially. And my childhood served me well because, for me, it turns out that everything, beginning with genetics, is material. I have always been strongly pro-life and pro-abortion, and I don't see the contradiction, and I'm not here to argue. No one asks to be born. Almost nobody wants to die, ever. It's enough to live, to be. Human consciousness is itself inexplicably miraculous, and life craves life forever. Even if this world were utopian, it would be unfair to bring a child into it unless you're going to put that kid first, every day, no matter what. That's what love is to a child. Not the house, not the car, not the job title. The kid comes first. The rest is an infinitely complex balancing act and pure chance. What makes the world cruel and ugly is always due to the same thing manifesting itself, love's absence, the inability and refusal to live by the truth that we are all connected, all one vast family, always have been, always will be. We may just be animals, with or without shoes, but we are humankind, and we share one lineage and, if you believe, one higher love. The one and only sure way of increasing the amount of love on the planet is to make a baby and raise that human with love. If you can do that, then it would be unfair to the cosmos, and especially to this miserable, magnificent planet, to its apex predator, and to any putative creator, to deny more life, to deprive creation of more love. In fact, this is our only hope. Children aren't hostage to the worst aspects of the human condition. They're here to improve it and to save what can be saved. You grow or save the world and humankind by loving yourselves and each other hard as you can. That's it. I mentioned my grandfather to my new son when we were talking about having kids. He wants his dad to be a grandpa before he dies because it would mean more to his dad than anyone. And that chokes me up. I'm near tears when I feel how warm and wonderful family love can be. I'm not a simpleton. All families are crazy. Not so very many are abusive. I love my little family, but good enough can get even better. That's my whole bucket list, I say, becoming a grandfather. And I tell him about Ipish, the only survivor on both sides of his family's generation, the only one not slaughtered. Not the whole story, just the only part that matters anymore. If that guy doesn't get on that boat, I say, I'm not me and you're not you. For what it's worth, I've patched things up with that old man. Too late for him. He died from a stroke in 1972, but much better for me than never. As I've aged, my eyebrows too have gone white. I see him for precisely what he was, another version of me, entirely lacking my mazel. He was what happens when the timing's wrong, when you marry wrong, when the DNA dice turn up boxcars, when your dreams are lost, and yet you have to keep trudging through the wreckage life has made of you. I got the only thing Ip had left to give me, what was left of him. Then and now I feel no guilt. I stood up to him for my brothers and me when no one in the world had our backs. As much as anyone could, he helped make me the writer that I am. I have felt the need to atone for what I did to him that day, and I've done my best. Guilt is looking back and feeling like a bad child. Atonement is moving forward as a better man. I named Judah after Judah Maccabee, an Old Testament warrior, but his first name in Hebrew is my grandfather's, Ephraim. My own misery, I'm aware you might well find far worse behind many front doors in this world, was all front-loaded. I have lived a hero's life and a fairy tale career and a great romance, every glad chapter of it thanks to timing. Good fortune has been nut-punching me for decades now. Barak Hashem. My new kids are lucky, too, for their nurturing, loving parents and for finding me, not some earlier putz with my name. If I'm still married to my first wife, 71, and never a father, it could not possibly feel like this does now. At best, it would have been hilarious and bittersweet and, I imagine, academic. If I'm still the 60-year-old father of a 13-year-old boy, hustling to build a college fund and nest egg, writing my ass off all night every night, two biological kids showing up out of my past would have been an emotional millstone for me, if not for Lisa and Judah, too. And if I'm some prior version of my besotted self, forget about it. These two children showed up right on time for me and for my little family. I'm free and free to love them all I want, and cringe if you must, I do. Which reminds me, I had a single conversation with the doctor at the fertility clinic after my daughter found me. He's been there the whole time, and he was happy that I was happy. And then I asked him if he knew any other kids who happened to be mine. "There's no way to know," he says. "No more than 10 was the rule for each sample. 10 minus 2 is 8. Huh. Lisa's fine with it. "We're all stardust," she says. "And who am I to argue? But are we expecting? Nah." And that concludes The New Dad. And now, Better Off Dad. Every man is afraid of becoming his father. There's a better way. We'll show you. Scientific fact, no one has ever smiled while saying the word father. Bowed their head in respect or fear? For sure. Followed it with the word figure? You know it. Included it in the title of their brave and unsparing memoir? You betcha. Magazines, this one included, loved nothing more than to furrow their brow and devote pages upon pages to the state of American fatherhood. It's no wonder, with a word, a figure, so looming that every man on some level fears turning into his father. Becoming a father is serious business, unless you work at the White House or are a surgeon of some kind. Raising a kid is likely the most important thing you'll ever do. The stakes are high enough to make a guy wonder whether he should be a father at all. Our radical suggestion? Don't do it. Don't become a father. Become a dad instead. You know the difference in your bones. A dad knows the name of the teacher, the best friend, and the kid who smells weird. A dad apologizes when he's wrong and does finger guns when he's right. He can tell you which sweatshirt is the itchy one. He does the voices when he reads the Berenstain Bears and can name at least a couple members of BTS. A dad makes his kids feel good, like someone in this tough world actually wants to be around them. But how to become a dad? We asked some dads we know for a few tips. You didn't ask? Guess there's one thing dads and fathers have in common after all. They love to give unsolicited advice. Here's ours. A quiz. Are you a dad or a father? How often do you start a sentence with the words, "Why, when I was your age?" A. Almost never. That's a 10-pointer. B. Occasionally. C. At least once a week. D. It's the title of my podcast. Your child is playing on a youth sports team. You A. stress sportsmanship, healthy competition, and the value of bringing enough orange slices to share. B. track team standings in a suspiciously thick binder. C. conduct frank post-game assessments of your child's play. Try not to be harsh, but there have been tears. D. remind your child it's not a foul if the ref doesn't see it. How do you help your child with homework? A. You work side by side, patiently guiding them to arrive at the right answers themselves. B. You do a nighttime run to the drugstore for a poster board, but no more than once a semester. C. You take one look at the worksheet and panic. Or D. Are they getting homework already? Your child is about to receive a participation trophy. You A. congratulate them. Showing up is an achievement, too. B. encourage your child to accept the trophy graciously, then throw it away in a couple of weeks. C. post a Facebook screed about kids today, participation trophies, and the goddamn mercy rule. You impart life lessons by A. making every effort to set a strong example. The surest way to give instruction is to model good behavior. B. buying your kid a subscription to Esquire. C. buying your kid a subscription to Foreign Affairs. Your child is helping you fix a leaky kitchen faucet when, out of frustration, you slam down a heavy wrench, seriously marring the countertop. You A, collect yourself, apologize for losing your temper, and explain that we all make mistakes, but that it's important to own up to them and try to do better. Or B, let a few choice curses fly, but then sheepishly say you're sorry. Or C, blame your wife for insisting on that polished granite countertop. That ugly green slab cost a fortune. All right, the A answers on that quiz were 10 pointers and scored the highest. And so here's the key. Tally your responses and see below. If you scored 50 to 60, well, congratulations, you're a bona fide dad. You're shaping young people of good character and probably won't be the subject of any tell-all memoirs. If you scored 30 to 49, you're solidly in the dad zone. Keep up the good work, and your children's future therapy bills should stay manageable. Scoring 10 to 29 points, you have some work to do. I'm glad you found us. And if you scored 0 to 9 points, you may in fact be a father, but it's not too late. Read on. And so we will. Is it okay to have a favorite kid? It's more than okay. It's the only way. Take it from Deion Sanders by Brady Langman. Deion Sanders might be better at tossing bon mots than at coaching football. The grizzled, never-not-controversial head coach of the University of Colorado Buffaloes is full of them. There's, if your dream ain't bigger than you, there's a problem with your dream. Or, I'm married to football. Baseball is my girlfriend. One more. Confidence is my natural odor. Fans eat up his sound bites, like Ralphie the Buffalo devours a bushel of grass at halftime. Then, on numerous occasions, including Father's Day last year, Sanders ranked his 5 children. Deion Jr., Shalomi, Shiloh, Shadur, and Deandra. Before you howl, he didn't rank his babies the same way each time. When journalists, in disbelief, followed up, he doubled down, saying, I'm the only one that's honest about ranking my kids. You guys act like you all love them the same, and you don't. Sanders declined to comment. Here's the thing. Coach Prime is right, and this sounds like a very big F father move, but it's really a classic dad move. Everyone has a favorite child. You have a favorite child, as in the Sanders household. Your favorite probably changes with the various kids' wins and losses. Today, the one who had to be told only once to put on his shoes is most likely ranking ahead of the one who made you late for work with a meltdown about why the banana wasn't yellow. Why not be like Prime Time and just admit it? When I'm a father of 5... Brady Jr., Furiosa, Peggy, Elvis, and Steve, you know damn well I'll be keeping my rankings on a whiteboard stuck to the fridge. Love you, Brady Jr. What my dad was right about. I was afraid of turning into my father until I did, by Michael Sebastian. Here's a story about my dad that he won't like me telling you. When I was, 10, I cleaned up spilled milk with our fabric toaster cover. My dad was not happy. You know, Michael, he said, sometimes you can be a real jerk. He wasn't wrong, and now that I have 2 of them myself, I know that everyone sometimes has this thought about their kids, but he said it to me. My dad was an asshole sometimes. He had a short fuse and a certain way of doing things, how he loaded and unloaded the dishwasher. Don't get me started. He worked all the time. He wore a suit and tie 6 days a week. On his one day off, he'd wake my older brother and me early to run errands, and he'd refuse to let us change the station on the car radio. He was a classic father. But he did give a shit. The old man showed up to every one of my baseball games, usually in that suit and tie. He persuaded his friend, a civil engineer, to build a toothpick bridge for a Boy Scout competition. We came in 2nd. I wanted for nothing, including the college education for which he paid. Then a funny thing happened when I became a dad. Despite trying not to, I also became my father. Not that it's all bad. I show up to games, even if it's usually in a jacket and tie. I help with Girl Scouts. But then there's the dishwasher. Why does no one know how to load a dishwasher properly? Coffee mugs go on the upper right rack. That's all about the geography of the kitchen, I explained to my wife and kids, who failed to grasp this. The cabinet where the mugs live is to the right of the dishwasher. When the mugs go where they belong, unloading is much easier. You save yourself a few steps in several minutes. Last month, I shared this strategy with my father. Smart, he said approvingly. I wish I could bottle and sell the pride I felt. And here's another fatherhood article. Show your kids an R-rated movie by Kevin Sintumwang. I watched Zack Snyder's Justice League with my kids when they were 8 and 5, and they liked it. I mentioned this, with a bit of guilt considering it's our rating, to Snyder during a Q&A. It's a pretty soft R, he told me, as if to say I wasn't that terrible a parent. Sure, I had to ignore the kids' questions about what the Joker meant by giving Batman a reach-around, but for the most part, if your kids can handle curses and some violence, they can handle soft R's. One of the best parts of being a dad is knowing which rules are okay to break. The fatherly refrain of no R-rated movies is one. Since then, we've added more soft R's to family movie night. Game Night, the Rachel McAdams Jason Bateman kidnapping caper, was a hit, too. Air, the story behind the making of Air Jordans, is totally family-friendly if you ignore the fact that they say nutsack. We've hit The Holdovers, an instant high school classic, Terminator 2, secretly about fatherhood, and Good Will Hunting. They'll need to learn about Boston somehow. Kids are more capable of understanding media than we give them credit for, and the more we activate that media critic in them and show them that movies can be pretty damn cool, the better. I watched Heat with my older daughter when she was 9, and she got it. The area between good guys and bad guys can be pretty gray. My younger daughter, now 8, wanted to watch Oppenheimer after it won the Oscar for Best Picture. I told her there was nudity. Well, why does a movie about nuclear bombs have nudity, she asked. Good question. I didn't have a good answer, but we'll watch it, skip over those bits, and talk about it. And now an interview. How to tell a dad joke. Interviewer, Josh Rosenberg. Interviewee, Jim Gaffigan. Dad jokes only seem easy. We asked Jim Gaffigan, comedian, father of 5, and founder of Father Time Bourbon, to break down the art form for us. What makes a perfect dad joke? Well, it has to be a bad joke. The most important thing is the fact that the joke is annoying to our children. A key element is we pretend to be unaware that it's a groaner. Do you have a favorite? There are some classics. I'm hungry. Hi, hungry, I'm dad. It has to be an observation on a very lazy connection of two seemingly unrelated ideas. Why do you think dads gravitate toward puns? Well, kids are dumb, so they're not going to get it initially, but as they get older, it becomes a joke that is shared. It's probably the most effective modern tool for communicating sarcasm that we have as human beings. Okay, and one more brief piece. The gear you need to level up your dadding. Diaper done. Snacks packed. Wisdom imparted. What further proof do you need that you're a dad? we recommend three items that will guarantee your status. A portable projector. Congrats on finally making it to the fun years from, let's say, age 7 to the dreaded start of teendom. How do you keep the kids interested in hanging out with you? Movie night and do it right with a portable projector. Pick it up by the handle, then watch the movie out back or in the kids' room. $1,300. And I must interject here, or spend $250 and mount it on the wall in your den. Dad sneakers. Don't forget, you need to look the part. Nothing says dad, let alone cool dad, more than the Made in USA 990s. $200 from New Balance. Snoo. The best, most valuable, and even most controversial topic concerning items for newborns is the snoo. It's a bassinet invented by Dr. Harvey Karp, a childhood development expert, and it's controversial mostly because of its price tag. Even if you don't buy the snoo, you'd better have an opinion on the snoo. Stat. And snooze. Cost $1,695. Oh, the drummer is drumming, and we know that means another hour has flown past here at Men's Magazines on Sunsounds Radio at sunsounds.org. I'm your host, Robert Streit, and I have enjoyed reading these many articles on fatherhood and the differences between being a father and a dad. And I hope you've enjoyed them, too. Sounds like we all can take some advice from Esquire and work on our dad chops. But all kidding aside, it's probably enough just to do our best. Between now and next week, let's do our best. And take care of yourself. Take care of one another. Peace.